You are listening to Within Tolerance, a podcast for machinists by a machinist. I'm your host, Dylan Jackson of Protean Machining. And this week, I am very happy to welcome Josh Shapiro to the show. Welcome, Josh.
Hi, Dylan. Pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. So for anybody who doesn't know who you are and what you do, give us the backstory.
Yeah, so I own and operate a high-end luxury watch business in Southern California in Torrance. It started out with just myself manufacturing high-end watch dials, doing a process called guilloche on these very old manually operated machines, and has really grown from there. And now we have a team of 10 and some pretty incredible machines that I feel very lucky to have and make some pretty special timepieces.
Awesome. Well, let's get into your backstory, because I know that I've listened to a couple of interviews with you, and it sounds like your life has been bookended by manufacturing. So where did it start? You know, how did you kind of go away from it, and how did you find your way back?
Yeah. So growing up, my grandfather was a machinist, and he started a machining business, a machine shop here in Southern California. He had worked on the Manhattan Project as a welder, didn't even know what he was working on, then came to Southern California and started the shop. And the most successful aspect of the shop ended up being sandblasting. And he had a very successful business doing that. And my father took over the business, and I grew up at the shop. My grandfather had a philosophy that he never liked to buy a new machine. So he had a giant yard full of old broken machines that he would salvage from. And this is the really fun environment I got to grow up in, just climbing on old machines and tinkering with things. So it was a pretty awesome childhood. And then, you know, I kind of went my own path, got into history from being around old stuff all the time, became an educator. And then around the time I got married, I really started returning back to my roots and looking to watchmaking and the manufacturing of components, and especially into guilloche engine turning, which is a very old world system of engraving. It's all done by hand, you and the machine, no motors, no electricity. Yeah, so that's the story in a nutshell.
So what drew you to guilloche? Because I heard in one of your interviews that you started with skeletonized watches, but then what was it specifically about, you know, rose engines and guilloche and all of that, that drew you to that manual side of it?
There's a watchmaker named Roger Smith, and he had put out a video in, I believe, 2012 or 2013, showing how guilloche works and how to make a dial. And I was so enamored by that video and the process that I really wanted to try it myself. It looked like a great just way to get into the watchmaking world. It looked like something that would appeal to me, the history of the machines, that I didn't need any super crazy specialized machines to support them. And I just dived in head first, and it really took a long time to produce work that I wasn't ashamed of. But they're incredible machines. I recommend anyone check them out just to see how they work. And anyone that appreciates machine tools will appreciate these rose engine or straight line machines.
Yeah, for sure. I was looking at a few of the videos on your Instagram, specifically the rings that you were doing. And it's so interesting watching that manual process and indexing everything. And it's definitely one of those mechanical nerd dreams of, you know, every little thing seems like it clicks and moves, and yeah, it's really satisfying.
Yeah. On the machining ends, you know, these rose engine machines are almost as old as lathes themselves. Even some of the earliest rose engine machines were the first true threading machines. With their ability to index, these were some of the first machines that screws were made on. So it's a machine that developed along with the roots of lathes themselves. They just kind of stayed frozen in time while the rest of machine technology kept evolving.
How cool. So talk to me about the transition. You said you picked this up as a hobby. You were still an educator. How did you divide up your time? How did you grow your hobby into a business? You know, how did that all happen?
Yeah, so around the time that I started becoming really serious about watchmaking is the same time that I was promoted to being principal of the school I was teaching at, this boys' high school. And initially, it was just, you know, maybe an hour or two a day I could dedicate to the watchmaking, and the rest was to the school. But then as the watchmaking began to grow, it began to be successful. I started taking less hours at the school, becoming more and more part-time. And so finally, you know, I think in 2021, the end of that school year, I left completely. But the nice thing about having the day job working as an educator was that it allowed me to reinvest anything I earned from the watchmaking side back into the company. And I was also a fiend on eBay. I loved buying and selling lathes and watchmaking tools and watches. And, you know, I just used that to keep reinvesting into the business as well. So it was definitely a step-by-step process, but I had a lot of fun all along the way, just building things up and kind of having the security of having one major job that could pay for life expenses. And with watchmaking, I could reinvest into it.
So what were the kind of things that you were selling at that point? Because I assume, you know, you were working on dials or parts of other people's watches or to modify other people's watches. So what exactly were you selling?
Yeah, so I was making dials for other makers. That was one of the main things I was doing, like the clock and watchmaker, David Walter in Santa Barbara, makes incredible things. And that was one of my first clients. And he taught me so much about machining. Side note, he has a really amazing lathe mill called Avali. And the headstock of the lathe also goes up and down. So you can use the headstock of the lathe for milling as well. It's a super full machine.
How interesting.
Yeah. And then the other thing I was really selling a lot was I was just buying and selling every Schaublin and Levin lathe I could get a hold of and kind of taking the best components from whatever sale I could find. In Southern California, there's a lot of machine auctions. There's so much machining, so much aerospace here. So whether it was on eBay or in auction, I really enjoy just going up and picking up these old machines, taking the best parts from it, refurbishing them a little bit, and then selling them again on eBay. And I must have bought 20 or 30 lathes, you know, for over a period of 5 or 6 years. Taught me a lot about lathes and was able to get some good machine tools out of it.
So this might be a good time to talk about finding some of these tools because, you know, some of the machine tools that you were buying are, like you said, incredibly old and one would think incredibly rare. So how did you find some of these, you know, straight line machines or Rose engines or things like that?
You know, with those machines, it's often who you know and who you can get in touch with. Like a great person, if anyone's interested in getting into these machines, is David Lindau. He actually manufactures Rose engine machines, and he's also just a great source for finding the old machines themselves. I would also, when I would get insomnia at night, I would just search classifieds in Switzerland and Germany to see if I could find any treasures listed on the classifieds there. And I actually did. I actually was able to find quite a few machines from Germany just looking through the classified listings in the middle of the night. So that was a lot of fun.
That's really cool. Yeah, I was listening to your talk on American watchmaking, and it was really interesting to hear kind of the rise and fall of it. And you know, how I don't think many people realize how much industry we had here for so long.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there still is so much going on in the United States, but it was even much more so before the 60s, whether in the watchmaking world or outside of it. Like the idea of buying something that wasn't American made is only something that's come about in the last 60 years. Before that, everything Americans bought was American made. And it was only really with China and Hong Kong and other foreign markets and the globalization that buying non-domestic products became a thing. And the watchmaking industry in particular was completely assassinated by the Swiss in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. So much so that the industry died completely, which is really a shame. But a lot of people, myself included, are pretty passionate about bringing it back.
Yeah, it's very inspiring to hear. So you were making these dials and things like that. Where did you go next? What was your next graduation of things that you were trying to task yourself with making?
Yeah, so I went from just like having a, you know, a Schaublin lathe and doing everything manually, making dial components manually. I started getting into fiber lasers and using that to engrave the indices on watch dials and cut out parts, discovering that world. And then around 2016, I bought my first CNC machine. It was a Dynamite 2400. It's this old desktop CNC machine from the 1990s. And a lot of people do conversion projects on them. So that was my first CNC, and that was a disaster. That was one of the machines I don't like to think about, complete loss. So then after that, I purchased this machine called a Real Mecha. They're made in France. This machine I got was from 1999. It was ancient. It could have like 76K of memory. It only had 5,000 RPM on the spindle, but it was very, very accurate, very rigid. It was a great little machine. And that's where I really learned how to CNC machine, do all the CAD, CAM, posting. If I wanted to do anything larger than 76K, I had to drip feed, and it was like RS-232 connection to a USB, and it was super wonky. But I really cut my teeth on that. And from there, I upgraded to a Haas office mill that I got from my friend, Josh Ogle, here in Southern California, who's a fantastic machinist, does a lot of bike parts. I'm sure people in the machine community have heard of him.
Yeah, he was on the show a year or two ago.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, he's fantastic. Yeah, so he really gave me my first start. He taught me how to use that machine. And that just enabled me to do a lot higher quality components using that Haas. It was plenty accurate for what I needed. And it allowed me to do, you know, prototyping for other components of the watch. Our first watch cases we made on that machine. I bought a second OM, I think, in 2020. And then eventually got a Schaublin 102 TM, which is a CNC lathe. And that allowed us to do more case components. By that point, one of my employees was Eric Storley, who's a fantastic watchmaker and machinist. And the team was starting to grow. You know, at that point, I believe you had four people. And then our first big, big non-dial project was making tantalum watch cases for a limited edition we did. And that was our first watch case. And it was in this crazy difficult metal tantalum to work with. I'm sure when I talk in the watch world, like no one really understands. They just know it's hard to work with. So they literally think it's a hard material. But I think people in the machining world appreciate that hard to work with means it's, you know, it's a gummy material. You know, like the surface finish is awful unless the cutter's in pristine condition, unless the speeds and feeds are dead on. But we learned a ton about machining and case making throughout that process. And that was a big stepping stone for us.
I had to look it up myself because I've never machined it and know of the element. But besides that, I had never really looked into it. And yeah, it sounds like it's quite the gummy material to machine.
Yeah, I mean, it's like no other material out there. It's like machining a mix of like copper, platinum, and Inconel or something. It's weird. It's not like anything else. But in the real world, in the non-watchmaking world, it's a super acid-resistant material that has all sorts of applications in the medical world and aerospace and research world. Very cool material. And then from there, we started working on manufacturing our own movements, which was a huge step up in difficulty. And that's when we picked up our Kern Evo from Dan and Kern Precision. And that was a huge game changer. I was very happy with the quality coming off of the Haas OM machines, but you know, the Kern Evo was like 10x of that. The surface finishes, the accuracy, it's just an incredible machine. It was fifth axis. You know, since then we've added more tool holders to the ATC and put in flood coolant. And you know, I just can't say enough positive things about that machine and how it's transforming our business.
That's awesome. So let's talk about what your current lineup of machinery looks like. You have the Kern. Do you still have both office mills? What other support equipment do you have?
Yeah, so we have the Kern. We have the Schaublin TM. We also have a Citizen L12 that we purchased new. That's going to be used for making all our really small components, pinions, staffs, stems, screws. Right now, we're doing those all manually on our lathes. We have 3 Schaublins and about 3 Levens, Harding HLVH that was redone by Babin Machine Tool. Incredible machine. And then we also recently purchased a Keyence LM, which can go down to submicron. We needed something that could measure things coming off of the kern, because the kern, you know, works in 1 or 2 microns. And we only had a CMM, this old Brown and Sharp CMM, that could do, you know, like at best 2 microns. So that was an incredible upgrade to the shop. The Keyence is super easy to use and fast, and, you know, allows us to measure these tiny, tiny features in our parts.
Yeah, it seems like a perfect fit for watchmakers. I know Zach, I think, has a similar one. We've talked about it and he's shown me, you know, readouts from it and stuff, and it seems incredibly easy to use.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Zach's the kern wizard. He's the one that came out, installed our upgraded ATC and Floyd coolant. Fantastic guy. I think I had lots of great people in this industry. Lots of great people.
Yeah. So let's talk about your movement and your, I guess I kind of want to go through the history of the watches that you have produced and sold, because they're all very interesting for different reasons. But I also want to get into the development of your own movement and how long that took and what that meant.
Yeah. So the first watch I launched myself was the Infinity Series in 2018. And it started off super classic, just like a precious metal case that we were outsourcing, a movement that we were outsourcing. And then we were making dials and hands and super intricate engine turn patterns, some that I invented. And that kind of put me on the map in terms of our dials and the complexity of them. And customers would come to me with ideas for customization, and I'd almost always say yes, sometimes to my own detriment. But we just did all these interesting things with this series over 5 years and experimented with all sorts of materials, whether it was zirconium, crystallized titanium, meteorite, all sorts of stuff. And so that ran for 5 years, and that allowed me to bankroll the prototype work for our movement. And a watch movement, typically, at best, people will just make the plates and bridges for a watch movement. Those are the largest components in a watch. And salvage parts from another movement, a donor movement, most commonly like an ETA 6498. People pull from there for all the small internal components. They're very costly and time consuming to make. And it's much, much, much easier just to pull it from another movement. And most collectors just pay attention to the bridges and plates. And, you know, people say it's an in-house movement, and that's a huge portion of what people do. And that's fine. You know, when I started out, I was not even doing that. I was just buying in a movement. But when we made our own movement, I wanted to go all the way, since that's the holy grail of watchmaking, is to try to do everything yourselves. It's the George Daniels method. And there are very few independent brands of watchmakers, not a part of the giant watch groups, that do this. And my team and I worked exceptionally hard to pull it off. It was extremely humbling, messed up a lot on the way, and had to learn a ton. And there's not a lot of people in the US you can go to for advice, and the Swiss are pretty closed-lipped. But we were able to come up with something we're very, very proud of. And, you know, of the 180 components or so in the watch, we made over 140 of them.
How many other companies in the US are actually producing that much of their own movement?
It's a little controversial, but I don't think any. You know, there are some brands in the US that, like I said, they use the plates and bridges, and then the internal components come from other movements. It's a little bit muddy waters, and it's a little bit muddy waters with USA made. US made is an exceptionally high standard compared to other countries. So what people are doing in this country would be way over the threshold to be called Swiss made. But in the United States, it needs to be all or virtually all. And the FTC doesn't explain what that virtually all is. So I used Hamilton Watch Company, who went out of business in the 1960s, as my model for what US made is, which, you know, they are making every component except for the jewels and their balance wheel. So on our watch, everything is US made except for the mainspring and some of the jewels. The rest of our jewels are coming from a company called Microlap in North Dakota.
Oh, wow. How cool. Yeah. That's quite amazing. And so you said, what was the timeline on the development? Like from when you first started drawing it up to when you had your first one that was working as intended?
About 4 years. About wow. 4 years.
That's quite the undertaking.
And yeah, I think we had a first alpha prototype in the fall of 2020. And then I had to table it to just keep funds coming in, grow the company, get more equipment in. And this final prototype, well, it's not even the final prototype. This beta prototype was finished in March 2023. And we're doing one more prototype right now to work out all the kinks we discovered from the last prototype. And that's something we're working on right now that hopefully will be done in this month. And then we're on to production.
Wow. How cool. So this might be a great time to talk about CNC in general in watchmaking, because I know from some people, it seems like there is a, you know, looking down their nose at CNC and, you know, they think everything should be handmade. And so how do you balance that viewpoint, you know, bringing in things like the Kern? How has that been to straddle those worlds of understanding that, you know, some of these are impossible to make at scale without automation like that? And then also, you know, collectors and customers wanting everything handmade.
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of smoke and mirrors in the watchmaking business around handmade. To me, handmade means really nothing. It's just, everyone has a different definition of it. It's more of a marketing term. In the watchmaking world, in-house is another marketing term too. It really means nothing. A lot of brands use it to mean a proprietary movement. If you look at the history of watchmaking, you know, from the 1870s onward, the Swiss and the Americans and all major industries were using automated cam-driven lathes and mills to do production work. And these machines were pumping out millions of parts, all pre-CNC. So automatic machinery has existed for a long, long time. I think for us, we choose certain aspects of watchmaking to finish by hand or to do guilloche by hand. And that's sort of the added value of our watches and the romance behind it, that one person is sitting there putting his life force into this watch, all this time into doing this hand function, whether it's engine turning or anglage on the bridges or damaskening. And then, you know, we choose which operations we want to do with our CNC machines that would, I guess there's no nice way to say it, that are less interesting, less sexy operations on the CNC machines that don't necessarily capture the imagination of collectors, that we do automatically. And if we didn't, if we just tried to produce everything on our manual lathes using non-automatic processes, you know, we could make one watch a year and we couldn't really have a business. I think that's the philosophy that most in the watchmaking world have. They do something similar to that. There's watches, you know, a certain price point that everything is machine done or automated. And then there's others at other price points where same thing. Some things are automated and some things are done by hand. And it's just sort of picking and choosing which operations and how you want to market it and how you want to sell your product.
Totally. Yeah. So speaking of the handwork, how long does something like one of your dials take, that the handwork alone in it?
Yeah. So just doing the engraving alone can, depending on the dial, could be 10, 20, 30, 40 hours.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Depending on the complexity, like the Infinity Weave alone can take, you know, days to do. Yeah, so it's a lot of work to do a dial like that by hand. In the industry, you know, to get a guilloche pattern, a lot of companies will either CNC it or stamp it. And I think Josh Hacko is the only one I know that is like proudly shows that he CNCs his guilloche and he gets tremendous results. And everyone else either just doesn't talk about it at all because it's not worth their time to talk about a CNC process for guilloche, or they let the customer imagination run wild.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's amazing. I mean, that is a ton of time to invest in something. And I imagine.
Yeah. Yeah.
An old teacher of mine used to say that, you know, a manual machinist has stress throughout the entire process, and the CNC operator or CNC machinist has all that stress condensed into the first part. And then for you guys to have both processes, you've got the stress of having a good CNC, you know, blank, and then having to then put, you know, 40 hours into something. I imagine there's a lot of focus dedicated to something like that. That's very intense.
A lot of scrap too.
Well, you mentioned Josh Hacko. Let's get into questions from the listeners. Josh asked, during your journey in watchmaking and machining, what were some of the inflection points that grew or pivoted your business in large ways?
I'll leave it to Josh for a great question. Complicated question. I mean, I think when I sort of upgraded from hobby lathes and mills, like Sherlines, to Levens and Schaublins, that was a big turning point. Not just for the increase in capabilities, because the Sherline is very capable, but sort of in me taking things seriously. Like, I'm sure everyone that's an entrepreneur in the machining world, you know, that the first machines you buy feel so expensive, even if they're only a few hundred dollars. Like, I can't believe I'm spending this much money on a machine. And then your tolerance for how much you're willing to spend on a machine just grows and grows and grows. But, you know, I remember, you know, the jump from spending $500 on a Sherline lathe to spending thousands on a Schaublin. Like, that was a big jump for me. That was a big moment. And then the same thing too, you know, like the Real Mecha CNC machine I bought from 1999, I paid like $8,000 for it. And that was every cent I had at the time. And then stepping up and buying the Haas OM, which was a huge game changer, you know, was a huge deal. Like, that first nice bit of technology, it was a new machine essentially. So it allowed me to come into the modern CNC machining world, and I wasn't having to figure out as much on my own. I had Haas for support, other people. That Real Mecha machine I had, it was obscure, and the company was in France, and there's almost no literature on it. Yeah, so that was a big game changer. And then I guess the same thing with my engine turning machines too. Like, you know, I had to sell my 67 Mustang Fastback to buy my first set of nice engine turning machines, but investing in that equipment allowed me to do professional level work. And I think that's something a lot of people can relate to. They probably listen to this. You know, the more you invest in the machines, the more you're investing in your business, the more you're investing in yourself, the better things you can make, and the more you're pushing yourself.
Yeah, I think that's that step up, you know, whether you want to call that lifestyle creep or whatever, or business creep, but I think we all go through it as you grow a business and really becomes more clear that it's okay to do that. You know, as you start finding success, you're just like, well, I'm already, you know, maybe it's a logical fallacy, but you're like, I've already come this far. I just need to keep making my life easier so that I can make better components or better products or whatever.
Yeah. I also think all machinists are kids at heart, and they've just upgraded to bigger and cooler toys. Like, the machines are, sure, they're our livelihood, but I think most people that work with machines every day love the machines and enjoy them. If not, why be in this business?
Yeah.
So totally. For me, you know, that even now, like, yeah, I used to be a watch collector, and then it got to a certain point where it was like, I could have a nice watch, but I'd much rather have a nice machine. Like, and then, you know, that kind of told me where my heart was. Even now, like, getting new machine tools or helping more to get more machinery, support equipment, tooling, like, that's always the most exciting part of the business for me.
Totally. Yeah, completely agree. I think we're all gear nerds at heart.
Yeah.
Josh's other question was, if you could go back and to the start of your journey, what advice would you give yourself?
Don't do it. No, I'm kidding. if you go back to the start of your journey, what advice would you give yourself? It'd probably be a long list of used machinery I've bought that I really wish I hadn't.
Oh, no. I think we've all been there as well, unfortunately.
Yeah. I think throughout the entire journey to this point, I've always kept something in mind that David Linda, who I mentioned earlier, told me. He said there are two types of craftsmen. Those that start out and immediately think their work is incredible and their growth is capped. They're not going to continue to grow and their work is usually not very good. And there's the second type of craftsman that always looks at his work and thinks, how can I improve this? How can I do this better? And this is the mindset I've had since the beginning, the learner mindset. Try to stay humble, try to stay humble, try to, how can I do better? How can I do better? How can I do better? And that advice served me really well. And luckily it was sort of right at the start of the journey. And I think without that mindset, I would have stopped or quit a long, long time ago. Instead, it really is a journey, and it's what you learn and grow along the journey, like in the pursuit of perfection. And, you know, I created this first watch where we'd done everything in-house. It was an incredible moment, but as soon as I made it, I was already thinking about how I could improve on it. And it really made me think how just important and meaningful the journey is. Even though I had reached a destination, it's this journey, it's this path of growing yourself and growing the business and having other people join you in the journey. That's the really special aspect of it.
I love that. That's great advice. IGS Dan, Dan that we both know, how much fun is tantalum to work with? And are there other even more challenging materials you're looking forward to working with?
Oh, yeah. Tantalum's a lot better now with the Kern and flood coolant. That material really loves a rigid machine. Like there's a big difference in surface finish from the OM to the Kern with tantalum that we're just now getting a feel for because tantalum is flammable and needs coolant. And we didn't have coolant and we didn't have fire trace system in, but we've got both those things now. We're excited to see what we can do. And then even more challenging materials are looking forward to working with. I mean, finding new materials to work with is both interesting for collectors and it's interesting for myself. So there's all sorts of things I'm looking into and want to see what we can do and explore and challenge ourselves with. Like I recently found a company in San Jose that can do custom alloys of any material. So there'll be a lot of fun things I'll be figuring out and playing with over the years.
Oh, cool. Both Tuck's Garage and Murph's Machine were asking about the difficulties. So Tuck's Garage said, what's the hardest challenge in making really tiny parts? And Murph's Machine said, what's the most difficult part to machine for your watches?
Yeah, so I think holding really tiny parts is extremely difficult. That's one thing. So fixturing, there's all sorts of different challenges for fixturing things that are so tiny. You know, we experiment with different types of glues. You know, we've switched over to the 3R system, but most of our things have to be, you know, you can't use screw tension to hold in a lot of our parts. So a lot of it is using sophisticated glue chucks to hold tiny flat parts. And then, speeds and feeds get pretty intense with tiny, tiny parts, because you need absolutely microscopic cutters for those. So even finding people to work with me that are game to try to do micro machining, it's definitely a different sector of machining. You know, most machinists are used to working on big things with tolerances that are larger than some of our parts are completely. So there's a lot of challenges with that.
And then what about your most difficult part to machine?
Yeah, so our most difficult parts to machines are our watch pinions and balance staffs. These are tiny circular parts Like I mentioned before, aren't seen by the collectors. So most of the time they're just outsourced. But we really wanted to do them ourselves. They're very challenging, but you can't make your own watch for scratch without making these components. So like a watch pinion has two pivots on it. And I just looked this up, like our smallest one, the diameters are about 75 microns, absolutely tiny. And in between the two pivots that are this size, can be the leaves for a pinion. So it has teeth on it, and the entire part, we machine it out of a material called AP20, which is free turning steel that we then have to harden. After we harden it, we have to polish the entire pinion because the teeth need to be extremely smooth. And then the pivots themselves, we do a burnishing operation, a grinding operation to get them absolutely polished and, you know, within a hundredth of a millimeter of the right size. And this is the component that is the staff that rides inside of the ruby bearings of a watch. So it's an extremely challenging part to make. For our prototype, we do it all manually. For production, we're going to do it on our Citizen. There's a lot of steps to it. These parts are absolutely tiny. You could fit 30 of them on your pinky. And the tolerances are extremely high.
Yeah, that sounds like a nightmare part. I imagine that the keyence comes in key there to measure them. Because otherwise, I mean, I don't know how you would measure them reliably without damaging some of them.
Right, yeah. We also have very delicate watchmaker-sized micrometers specifically made for this task. But the keyence is also super helpful, especially with the forms of the teeth. Keyence is a very, very, very fancy optical comparator. And, you know, we need to know if the forms of our leaves are the correct size. And that's very helpful with that machine.
How cool. Tux Garage also asked, where do you get the inspiration for your designs?
Yeah, so, I was definitely influenced by Abraham Louis Breguet, the person that was a revolutionary in the watch business. You know, George Daniels, Roger Smith, some of these other watchmakers, a lot of watchmakers have used that very classic aesthetic. So originally, that was one of my big inspirations. For the resurgence, I kind of took things my own way, plus being inspired by some aspects of American pocket watches, some aspects of great Swiss watchmaking, and just things from my own head. I guess recently, I think where I'm gonna be going is, you know, I've really started a deep dive into automobiles and car history and racing and understanding the relationship between watches and chronographs and watches and cars. And so that's a direction I'm starting to look into, and looking into like a more modern aesthetic as well. I feel like I've really explored the classical and dress watch realm quite extensively. And, you know, I'm looking forward to exploring modern and other aesthetics and other influences.
Awesome. So what made you go with three different movement styles, or I guess they're the bridges on the backside? That seems like, you know, you were already doing something insurmountable and you said, yeah, let's make it a little harder.
Yeah. I guess it was, you know, making the bridges and the main plates, those are the largest components in a movement. So they're complex, but they're relatively easy compared to doing all the tiny guts of a watch. So there are different design aesthetics that I wanted to explore. One of my watchmakers, Michael Rose, you know, he wanted to do some movement design. And there's a Swiss watch company, you know, back in the 1910s that would offer two different designs. And I thought that was just so cool. Like, you know, we can give customers the option to choose between three different movements. And for us, it's not too much extra work because we're already making all the internal components, but it's just something special and added that we can offer for our watches that's pretty unique. Usually, like a company, if it's a different bridge layout or design, it's a different watch altogether. So for ours, there's quite a lot of customization, both that you can have three different choices in the movement, and there's different dial color options. And our case design is also modular, and the lugs of the case are detachable. So it gives the customers a lot of room to play, and it keeps things interesting for us. We're not just making the same watch over and over and over again.
Yeah, that's totally fair. Let's see, Merce Machine, other question was, what's the most difficult assembly process for your watches?
I'd say it's, you know, putting the escapement together in a watch. You know, in clocks, the pendulum is the regulating organ of a watch in a clock. In a watch, it's the escapement with the balance spring and the balance wheel, and there's vibrating and poising, and getting that all set up is very, very challenging. And I guess, you know, we tried to make this watch as thin as possible. And the thinner you go, it means the closer all the gears and components are to each other. So sort of designing things in a way where all the different components of the watch can come together smoothly without making it impossible to assemble all together. So that's been a challenge.
Sure, that's really tough
as well, keeping it thin. Yeah.
All right. Well, that brings me on to shop news and new things. You've already said that you are just, you know, getting ready to finish your last beta movement. Anything else new or exciting in your shop?
Let's see. Right now we're experimenting with our centrifugal barrel finishing machine, trying to use that to polish these tiny pinion parts instead of doing it by hand. Trying to figure out how to get a Curran HD into the shop so I could be cool like the hack goes. And the big thing is this week we're getting our training on our Citizen L12. And I'm actually really looking forward to that because you don't need any CAD or CAM to program that machine. It can all be done on the controller since the parts aren't that complex. So other people in my shop that aren't CAD CAM savvy are interested in learning it. I'm interested in learning it. We've been buying all the tools for it, and it's been cool learning like a completely different system. Yeah, I'm used to lathes, I'm used to mills, but you know, a Swiss lathe just operates in a very different way than I'm used to. And it's fun just learning a completely new system. I guess the next frontier for a completely new system would be like a wire EDM machine or, you know, sintering, 3D printing sintering type machine. But that's in the far, far future.
Yeah, but either of those would be really cool to add to your arsenal of machinery for sure.
Yeah.
Well, that brings me then to the last two questions I ask every guest every week. The first of which is, what did you research this week? Doesn't have to be manufacturing related. It's just always interesting to see what interesting people are looking into.
So I started reading the book Go Like Hell, which is about the 1950s and 60s racing culture from the manufacturing side of Ford and Ferrari. And that's been a really fun read. It's like on one side, you learn about the manufacturing side, how they built up these companies, how marketing played such a huge role in that, and how racing played a huge role also from the marketing side, also from the technology side. And learning about like the difficulties that Henry Ford II was going through and Enzo Ferrari, and learning that even though these guys were like giants and legends, you know, they had tremendous challenges. Like I just got to the part where Iacocca is so proud that he's launched the Ford Mustang, and he goes to the Indianapolis 500 and two Ford cars collide into each other and explode and kill both the race drivers. And so he's from the highest of the highs to the lowest of the lows within a few days. And
oh, wow.
And it's just cool hearing that, because sure, every business owner, every machine shop owner, you know, you have your highs like, yes, nailed this part. And then, you know, a week later, something breaks in one of your machines or you crash a machine. It's the lowest of lows and now you're down. And you know, a few months later, you have another great success and just the sort of natural flow of ups and downs. And I always think when I think of like legends in the business that it was just smooth sailing, but it never is. It never is for anyone. And that's very cathartic.
Yeah, for sure. No, I've said a few times on the show to many people that this trade has a way of continually humbling you. And, you know, like you said, you know, you think you're on top of the world. And then the next day is when you crash your expensive tool and break it and have to learn a expensive lesson, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah. Big time. Big time.
And then the other question I ask every guest every week is, what are the things you're working on to be a better person or leader or employer? You know, none of us are perfect. We're all working on stuff. What are you working on?
Yeah. So one of the things we're working on is trying to integrate 3S system into the workshop and just finding ways to motivate people for that or figure out how to do that. You know, I'm always trying to figure out ways of and systems of better organizing myself, which in turn helps the company tremendously. As an entrepreneur, I'm still so involved in so many things. So my own personal time management is something I'm always trying to get better at and learn more about and try different methods. And then, you know, just trying to stop and listen and understand my employees for sort of to seek to understand first, instead of, you know, just running this business from a pulpit and always sending, trying to receive and understand and gather input the best I can.
Wonderful. Yeah. I think that those are really difficult things to do. You know, you get so lost in the weeds of running a business that it is really hard to have a global view like that. And so I definitely think that that's a great thing to work on.
Yeah. No, great questions. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, this is really wonderful. It's great to be on a podcast that's machinist oriented. Daniel Gonzalez is our CNC machinist. And I know he listens to this and he's, you know, been huge for our company and growing it and a really fantastic guy and a diehard machinist. And I've learned so much from him and, you know, and hopefully we'll continue to grow and find new machines to play with.
Definitely. I look forward to seeing where you guys go next. Thank you much. Thank you to all the Patreon members, new ones this month, Michael, Jarrett, Nick, John, and Ross. Thank you all for making this show possible. It lets me send people like Josh a headphone and mic so you guys have good audio. Thank you all for listening, and I will be back next week.